From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, just like you. And we are very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday marks St. Patrick's Day, celebrated by folks far beyond the feast's Irish Christian origins. Wednesday, followers of Scientology observe the birthday of L. Ron Hubbard. And after the winter we've endured, it might be particularly appealing to join Wiccans and pagans in welcoming the spring equinox on Friday, celebrated as Ostara in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
An open internet is vital for our organizing efforts in social justice.
It's been a hot topic in recent weeks. Action by the Federal Communications Commission to recognize the way the internet has evolved to become a necessity of modern life, a utility, if you will. Under the broad label of net neutrality, the FCC passed broad new rules last month and published the details on Friday, all in the face of widespread corporate and conservative opposition. Among the advocates for an open internet has been Valerie Carr, founder of the influential Groundswell Movement website at Auburn Seminary in New York City. And on this week's show, I'll ask Valerie why this issue is so important to communities of faith and social action in our digital age.
An online initiative encouraging Muslims to show solidarity with Christians during Lent is growing. Muslims are posting photos online of things that they're giving up for Lent using the hashtag #MuslimsForLent.
It's the brainchild of Basil Ritchie, a Muslim American who will be with us in the coming hour to discuss the thinking behind this inspiring idea. But first,
this place where the powerless could change the world's greatest power and push their leaders to expand the boundaries of freedom. They saw that idea made real right here in Selma, Alabama.
Last weekend, tens of thousands of Americans gathered in Selma, Alabama, to observe the 50th anniversary of what's come to be known as Bloody Sunday. This seminal day in civil rights history started with a gathering at the Brown Chapel AME Zion Church on March 7, 1965. And on this important anniversary, numerous faith leaders and faith-inspired activists were in attendance. Joining me now is one of those faith leaders, the Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis, Senior Minister at Middle Collegiate Church in New York City. Jackie, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
When I say Selma, what's the first word comes to your mind?
Victory.
Now tell us what the commemoration in Selma last weekend was like.
It was beyond anything I could have ever imagined. You know, I was 5 years old when those men and women and children put on their Sunday best and walked into an unknown, uncertain situation. They had to know that there would be resistance. They had to know there'd be violence, and they were trained for that. But I can't imagine that they could have anticipated the just vitriolic violence that they faced as they hoped to claim their right to vote. So as a five-year-old, I was deeply, you know, wounded by those images of clubs and police on horses and a cloud of tear gas. So we know it took them three tries to get across the bridge, and we also know that those images really shook our nation up and led to the passing of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. So I stood in front of Brown Chapel with Melissa Harris Perry and bunches of sheroes and heroes from the movement, and I walked in the sea of people toward the bridge and just thought, I am now a part of a moment in time that is historic and spiritual and life-altering.
Jackie, what were you seeing and what were you feeling in the crowd?
Well, there was a woman named Minnie, about 70 years old, pushing a walker in her coat, And I walked over to her and I said, you know, what's your name? And she said, you know, I'm Minnie. I said, why are you here? She said, I have to walk. I just have to walk. I walked before and I'm walking now. There were babies in strollers. There were old grannies, you know, literally the grannies, singing civil rights songs. Mm-hmm. There were a horde of Unitarian Universalists all in Standing on the Side of Love t-shirts. There were young couples holding hands and walking as though sauntering into the future. There were twin boys, Joshua and Jacob, who told me that their names came from the Bible and that they were there to honor Martin Luther King and also just because they could be. It was a multiracial, multicultural, it looks to be interreligious group of people all wanting to be in the space.
What was going on inside Jackie Lewis?
Wow. I was deeply moved. I was so emotional. What inside myself was pride. My ancestors worked for the Voting Rights Act. My great-uncle George was an activist in Mississippi, and my mother sang in a choir with Fannie Lou Hamer. So it was a personal pride and an institutional pride, a time when our nation pulled together to make a good thing happen. And I was also sad, thinking about where we are today and the kind of eruption of racial tensions in our nation and the sense that though we have made progress, we haven't quite overcome. And at the same time, a kind of hope, mm-hmm. because I am seeing signs, what my friend Brian calls pockets of resistance around the nation where this movement is still in place and people are still working for human rights and civil rights. Mm-hmm. So it was a mixture of things.
You mentioned that you saw evidence of interreligious cooperation. What did that look like? Because I'm curious as to what kind of faith traditions were a part of that commemoration. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I had a chance to actually speak with Susanna Heschel, Rabbi Heschel's daughter.
Oh, boy.
And she reminded us of his amazing words about how, you know, walking is prayer, our legs are praying. He also said, you know, our legs are singing. And she said that a bunch of Jewish people were there because the civil rights movement actually gave them back their prophetic Judaism. It saved their souls. So I knew that there were Jewish people. I could tell there were Jewish people. I saw a couple of people in Hajid, women, liberal women. And my assumption, because I'm working with some colleagues in the Black Lives Matters movement, mm-hmm. that there were Muslim people there, you know, all kinds of Muslim people that would not have necessarily, you know, looked Muslim to the world. But I'm assuming that they were there as well, and I did see those few women in Hajib.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked to me like Unitarian Universalists. It looked like Christians. I saw a couple of people looking like in clerical collars, so that often is Episcopal priests or Catholic priests. I was there in a, you know, in street clothes as a Protestant clergywoman. I imagine that there were people whose only faith is in the human spirit to survive.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, we've seen in a number of national surveys now that the state of America and life in America looks very different to people depending on the racial composition of the communities they inhabit. Views on policing practices are a good example of that, of course. How can we begin to bridge some of these disparities and start to see the world through each other's eyes?
What an important question that is for a day like today and a time like this. I think one of the things that we have to do is to celebrate the stories of our past. So this commemoration doesn't commemorate the violence. That was horrible. But the way that the march, the movement began to include white students and Jewish people and black folks and white clergy people, like James Reeb, who lost his life, a Unitarian Universalist minister, Rabbi Heschel, that part of the story where what happens is that people join together across difference toward a common goal. That's an important lesson for us. And what can happen is we can begin to think racial, ethnic differences, cultural differences should be smooshed, you know, into a non-distinct pablum. Mm-hmm. That's not true. I think when we celebrate the difference, when we acknowledge the difference, we create a stronger human family, a stronger human fabric. Mm-hmm. So we need to have cross-racial coalitions. We need to have interracial congregations. We need to have interreligious collaborations that are not just about celebrating Martin Luther King Day, but where people in cities and farming towns find the imam and find the rabbi and find the clergy and develop relationships of trust. And that is what's happening. Last month, many of us were drawn together by Bembe Arc, a Jewish mm-hmm. organization, to go to D.C. and do a die-in for Black Lives Matter. So this was Jews mm-hmm. and young Muslim people and young Black students and Christians. If we do this together, we can have the power to heal our land. Interreligious, interracial, and intergenerational is what mm-hmm. we need to do.
What do you consider the number one priority for civil rights advocates in 2015?
It's racial justice. Mm-hmm. Some people will say it's the economy, and I would say race correlates to economy. Race correlates to incarceration. Race correlates to health care, to infant mortality, to HIV infection. Race correlates to wealth, to housing patterns, to where children go to school. It is the salient issue in our nation, and what happens is we pretend because we have a Black president and there's a rising wealthy class of African-American people that somehow race doesn't matter. It does. It correlates to immigration. This is our issue, and now is the time to put it squarely before us, especially for people of faith who believe that God made all of us wonderful and awesome in God's image. We have to take the lead to dismantle racism in America.
Jackie, if going out of that worship center, you could have shouted anything you wanted to shout, tell me what you would have said.
It's not finished. And yes, we can do this.
The Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis is senior minister at Middle Collegiate Church in New York City. She's executive director of the Middle Project. Last weekend, she traveled to Selma, Alabama, to take part in the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Jackie, thank you again for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. And if your viewers want to see more of the story, go to middlechurch.org and see some great pictures. Okay?
Terrific. This past week, I noticed a strident column in the conservative Washington Times decrying the Federal Communication Commission's new rules on net neutrality as an existential threat to religious freedom. Huh? Joining me now to shed some light on this issue is a pioneer in online faith-based activism, Valerie Kaur. Valerie's the founder of the website groundswell-movement.org, housed at Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, where she serves as a senior fellow. She has been on State of Belief. She is a bright person. I'm glad she's back. Valerie, welcome again to State of Belief Radio.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
For those of us further away from the digital frontier, would you be kind enough to summarize what's involved in the discussion on net neutrality?
Absolutely. The first thing to understand is that the future of religious life and interfaith cooperation in America depends on a free and open internet, which means it depends on net neutrality. Now, net neutrality can seem like a really confusing issue. It was to me before I really learned what was at stake. But it's really very simple. It's the idea that the internet should remain a place where every person, no matter the color of our skin, the content of our beliefs, or the size of our wallets, should have an equal chance of reaching people online. What's happened is that large providers like Comcast and Verizon, they have a profit incentive to want to control more what happens online, to block or slow down sites or charge us fees in order to reach people faster. But this would essentially end equality on the internet as we know it. So the good news is that in the last year, more than 4 million people of all faiths and backgrounds made their voices heard, submitted comments into the Federal Communications Commission, the federal agency responsible for rules governing the Internet. And as a result, just last month, the FCC reclassified the Internet as a public good, as essential as water or electricity, and they adopted strong, bright-line rules to protect the Internet as we know it. So this is necessary for innovation, for economic growth, for democratic discourse in America. It's also vital for the future of religious and spiritual and interfaith life in the United States.
So, Valerie, how does the FCC's ruling impact faith communities specifically and activists in general, and are you happy with it or worried about it?
I am celebrating it. It's a fight that I've been honored to take on in the last year. 1 year ago, the vote for strong protections for the open Internet seemed impossible, but it was thanks to a groundswell in the last year that made this victory possible. What we have to understand when we think about faith communities is this. The Internet has become the prophetic platform of the 21st century. We're seeing a new generation of faith leaders, progressive and conservative, connecting with their congregations, serving their communities, organizing for social change, all online. So take traditional religious life. Churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, gurdwaras, other houses of worship, they're all relying on the Internet as part of their basic operations, posting sermons and bulletins, raising funds, building online communities. In a time where many traditional religious communities have to innovate in order to reach new generations, a free and open Internet, the kind that the FCC has voted to protect, is essential for us to run our houses of worship effectively and remain relevant in the 21st century. But as a millennial, I know that the future of interfaith cooperation in America is also at stake in this issue. The open Internet right now is a place where we can engage people who are different from us, a Sikh or a humanist or a Muslim. We can hear their stories. We can engage with them in ways that we can't in the real world. At least we can take those first steps online. And millennials are driving entirely new online platforms for interfaith engagement in bold new ways that include dialogue, service, advocacy. We can think of the work of Interfaith Youth Corps or publications like State of Formation. And as you mentioned, working with a team at Auburn Seminary, I founded Groundswell a few years ago to do exactly this, to help give faith leaders online tools to fight for social change. Groundswell has now become the largest multi-faith online organizing community in the country, and this simply would not have happened without a free and open Internet. So think, if we had to pay Comcast or Verizon special fees in order to reach people faster so that they wouldn't encounter the spinning wheel of death when they went to our site, we wouldn't have even gotten off the ground.
Hmm.
So if we want to see more innovation in the future, especially in terms of religious and spiritual interfaith life in America, this vote is something to celebrate.
You mentioned Groundswell, the groundswellmovement.org, and how far it's come. Talk about the importance of that, and then we will transition back into the conversation about the Internet.
Yes. Well, Groundswell could not have become what it has today without the open Internet, and this is true for so many online innovations in America today, especially for activists who care about social change. In the last year alone, we've seen organizers use online tools to stop deportations, to halt executions, to respond to hate-based violence. Without the open Internet, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson would not have become a national story as quickly as it did, nor would we have heard calls for justice through hashtag Black Lives Matter or most recently Muslim Lives Matter. In fact, every social issue we care about in America today requires a free and open Internet as a necessary tool for 21st century change.
How was all of that threatened? What were your concerns as the FCC was formulating its decision and rulings?
Well, the FCC was listening closely to the needs of large internet service providers like Comcast, like Verizon, like AT&T. These large providers wanted more control over what happens online. They wanted the ability to be able to block or slow down certain websites according to their needs, according to their desires to manage the network. Mm-hmm. But they also wanted the power to charge access fees for certain sites to reach people faster. So this means that commercial providers, like big companies like Netflix, would be able to reach their audiences faster because they could pay the fees. But essentially, any non-commercial speakers, so educators, artists, activists, faith groups, faith leaders, all of us would not be able to afford those fees. It would mean that we would be essentially in the slow lane on the internet. In civil rights terms, we wouldn't be in the back of the bus. We would be on a whole separate bus down a dirt road. So there was so much at stake for faith groups in the fight for net neutrality, and yet so few faith communities really could understand the issue enough to know what was at stake. Mm-hmm. So that's why my next step after Groundswell was joining forces with Cheryl Lienza of the United Church of Christ. We founded Faithful Internet. It's a project coordinated by Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society and the United Church of Christ Media Justice Ministry. And our work is to amplify the voices of faith leaders on this issue. You can go to our website, faithfulinternet.org, to hear voices like Reverend William Barber on the streets of North Carolina. He said that right now the web is a place for all Americans to have an equal voice. We need to keep it that way, especially for our organizing of the Moral Mondays movement and other organizing around the country. You can also hear the voice of Helen Ostman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who says that the Pope Francis's inspirational message could only be shared with millions of people because of the open internet. You can also hear the voice of Congressman John Lewis, who says that we need the internet for this generation and for generations yet unborn, for all the movements yet to come.
Valerie,
I
want to interrupt just to ask that there are voices claiming that the new rules open the door to government censorship of internet content for the first time. Do you see any sign of that as something to worry about?
These folks have it totally wrong. It's not that the FCC is regulating the internet. They're regulating access to the internet, which means that they're ensuring that all communities have equal access to the internet. And so it's really, really important to understand that many folks who are claiming that the FCC decision is bad for America are folks who really are listening closely to the profit incentive needs of large internet service providers. Mm-hmm. And on the other side are 4 million Americans, dozens of lawmakers, entrepreneurs, startups, artists, educators, innovators of all kinds who are together claiming that this is actually something to celebrate and to defend in the weeks and months to come.
Hmm. Valerie, you are, among so many other things, a visionary. What are the next opportunities for using the internet for good going to be, in your opinion?
Well, I think about my own life. As a lawyer, as a filmmaker, as a sick activist, I realized that my entire life's work would not have been possible without the open internet. I made my first film about hate crimes after 9/11. No one would have ever heard about this work if it weren't for me blogging about it. And in every campaign since, we've used it to tell our stories. You know, most recently, as you know, Welton, in the aftermath of the mass shooting in Oak Creek that took the lives of sick Americans, it was the largest attack on a faith community since the 1963 church bombing that took 4 little girls, and yet the media trucks left all too soon. But we were able to keep the story alive through social media, through blogging, through posting essays and videos. We were able to organize to get the federal government to change their policy on hate crimes in the United States. I see that the future of internet innovation really points to equipping more communities like mine, like the sick community, communities that are historically less visible, communities that are marginalized, in bold new ways to tell our stories, to organize for social change, to shape democratic discourse in the United States.
Mm. Valerie Kaur is an award-winning filmmaker, activist, and public speaker. She's the founder of groundswellmovement.org at Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, where she's a senior fellow. She's also, I just found out today, a new mother. I have to say to you, Valerie, I've missed talking with you. You are so knowledgeable on so many different fronts and so articulate in helping us understand what we need to understand and how to build bridges instead of causing separation. It's always great talking with you. I'm confident that you're going to be as good a mother as you are speaker, filmmaker, activist, and so much more. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
That means the world to me, Wilton. Thank you.
It was in 2012 that we introduced you to the Reverend Wes Magruder, a Texas Presbyterian pastor who had joined Muslim friends in observing the Ramadan fast that year. It's undisputable that the greatest tensions in our diverse world come from an unfamiliarity with those we perceive as different from ourselves. I think it's powerfully hope-giving to not only learn about, but also to experience the lives and the traditions of others. That's why a social media campaign launched for this year's Christian observance of Lent, the season leading up to the Easter celebration of Christ's resurrection from the dead, immediately caught my attention. Hashtag Muslims for Lent. That's the brainchild of Basil Ritchie, and I am pleased to have him join us right now on State of Belief Radio to talk about this interesting initiative. Basil, welcome.
Hi, Wilton. Thanks for having me.
Where did the idea for Muslims for Lent come from?
Well, it was kind of an evolving idea, actually. It started at my time at the University of Houston, where I was a part of the Muslim Student Association on campus there. And every year during Ramadan, we would have what we called a fast-a-thon, which would encourage non-Muslims to join us in a day of fasting in solidarity. And then at the end of the day, you know, we had a big banquet room booked out, and, you know, we had a big spread of food, and we would all break our fast together and then share in kind of interfaith dialogue, and people would come up at the end, non-Muslims would come up and talk about their experience fasting for the first time and similarities between their religion and Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was overall, it was a great experience. You know, just looking around the room, you know, we had to end up booking a larger room because there was so many people interested in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was probably, you know, a couple thousand people altogether. And I was seeing, you know, different faces, different religions, all taking a step in trying to understand our beliefs better. And as you said, you know, when you take a step to understand other people, it creates a more harmonious society. So a few years of reflection, you know, I decided personally to take a step and show my appreciation to the Christian community and fast with them in solidarity. And so I put up a little Facebook status and talked about the similarities between Lent and Ramadan. And then it just kind of evolved. And towards the end of last year, I had this idea to make it bigger, and I talked to some friends and bounced some ideas around, and we created this hashtag. And I said to somebody that, you know, I'll be happy when somebody that I don't know puts the picture up and joins the campaign. And I think we've done really well.
So what is the participation like in this campaign?
The response has been amazing. You know, just from Christians talking about how supported they feel, you know, that other people are taking a step towards them. Other Christians that never really fasted for Lent now are kind of like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot, which is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone, you know, connecting with their faith is a beautiful thing. And then with the Muslim community, who are always, my experience has been that, you know, we're very eager to represent, you know, what we believe Islam really is. And it's about tolerance, it's about respect, it's about peace, you know, and it's contrary to what, you know, it's sometimes displayed in the media about Islam. And so part of this effort is for us to put ourselves out there and hopefully take, you know, the spotlight away from the extremist people that have hijacked it.
Has anybody told you that you're crazy and you just shouldn't be doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. On both sides, I think. You're always going to have people that aren't going to understand what you're doing. And I think the validation is that, you know, of, you know, maybe the 5% or so of the people that have been bashing us, you know, maybe I can count on one hand the people that have personally, you know, sent us a message to try to really understand what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. And, you know, where the heart is. And I think that tells it all. You know, that's the people that are unwilling to see anything outside of their scope of understanding, and they can't take the step to say, hey, maybe I should ask a couple questions before I make my decision. Uh-huh. No, they just make their decision. And that's okay, you know, that if someone, you know, in their heart feels like this is something that they don't want to do, whether it be Muslim or Christian, you know, if they don't want to support us on the Christian side, mm-hmm. that's fine. But for the people that are supporting us and for the Muslims that are doing it, they're seeing, you know, those barriers being broken down. They're mm-hmm. being approached by people who traditionally did not approach them to ask about these questions and give an opportunity for someone, you know, that's a Muslim to talk about all of these misconceptions that have mm-hmm. been swirling around. And that's part of the goal.
Sure. Well, I know that unless those participating self-identify, you wouldn't know the answer to this. But do you have any idea whether the participants have gone beyond just Christians and Muslims?
I have been seeing some tweets from Jewish people that are on board. I think there was this one rabbi online, and she posted Jews for Muslims for Lent, and yeah. she created her own hashtag, you know, to show her support of the movement. And so, yeah, we have had other religions jump on board. We've had even people of non-belief mm-hmm. Jump on board and say, you know, this is fascinating. I don't particularly, you know, have a set of beliefs that I follow. But then even some of them have said, you know, yeah, I actually gave up, you know, apple pie for Lent, even though I'm not religious. So I think we've touched a lot of people, uh-huh. and it's pretty great.
Tell me something about your own experience with fasting.
Well, I've fasted for Ramadan since I was, I think, maybe in fifth grade or so. It's always tough to do, right? But I think that's the point. You know, if it was easy, it wouldn't be as meaningful to the person. You know, and so yeah, I think fasting in any sense is a beautiful kind of spiritual act. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? It helps us get in touch with what's important in life. You know, mm-hmm. so during Lent, you sacrifice. One of the things that I've learned about Lent is that the sacrifice is only a small part of what Lent is really all about. You know, it's mm-hmm. many people have wrote in saying that we're also supposed to help the poor. We're supposed to, you know, try to, you know, find bad habits about ourselves and improve on that. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a lot of Ramadan. You know, there was a quote that went around that said, you know, if you just abstain from food and drink during Ramadan, all you're doing is making yourself hungry. Again, you're supposed to help the poor. You're supposed to find ways to be a better member of the community, a better husband, a better wife, mm-hmm. a better son or daughter. You know, you're supposed to try to advance yourself and mm-hmm. then use that 30 days or 40 days for Lent and keep it going for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And so I think regardless of the religion, the idea of fasting is a truly wonderful thing. And I think that was one of the first things that you know, really touched me, as I noticed just how similar Lent and Ramadan really are. You know,
right.
it's almost like we're the same people, just with a slightly different rule book, you know.
Basil, I really am so impressed by what you've done, because you have done what so many people need to do, and that is to bring about interaction between people in different religious traditions and no religious tradition. You surely see the benefits of this, but I wanted to compliment you on it first, and then tell me what comes out of this that's most important in your own experience.
Thank you so much for your kind words. I think the importance of it, you know, can be touched up on several points. You know, one of them is just simple, display of respect and affection for mm-hmm. people of other faiths. Right. You know, in this day and age, the rhetoric of, you know, there's only one path to God, mm-hmm. I don't think is something that resonates with me. You know, I think that God presents himself to different people of different cultures in different ways. And part of us making sure that the world that we have is a great place to be is respecting that and mm-hmm. respecting our differences and uniting on the things that we have in common.
Right.
Particularly now with how the Muslim community can be portrayed or beliefs about Islam can be portrayed, you know, in light of Islamic-related extremism, I think it's a great tool to allow people to be more accessible to a Muslim person.
Uh-huh.
You know, the hope in some ways is that, you know, we can put ourselves in front of more people using social media. And, you know, they will see our face and they will see what we look like. And they'll see that, you know, Muslims in America or around the world, you know, they come in all different shapes and sizes. We look different. Some women wear the headscarf, some do not. And some guys have, you know, a little bit of a beard and some do not. We all look different.
Right.
But, you know, here's hoping that we can be accessible. So when someone tries to push a misconception about what Muslims believe or what Islam is all about, then the people on the receiving end of that can say, wait a minute, you know, no, I saw this campaign online, or I saw pictures of these Muslim people doing, you know, everyday things. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound right, but maybe I can reach out to them and ask questions.
I've got to interrupt you because we're just about out of time, and I don't want to miss saying how creative you've been with your website. Your website is Eid Pray Love. Say just a word about it and encourage people to go before we get off, please.
Well, I appreciate that. One of the things that we're trying to push now is to create a section of that website called Ask a Muslim. And so for anybody, you know, out there that ever has any misconceptions or misunderstandings or just, you know, wants to know more, you know, we want to create this feature. So go to the website and send us a message with your questions, and hopefully we can engage in a dialogue and help, put away misunderstanding and grow closer together.
Basil Ritchie is the creator of the hashtag Muslims for Lent campaign and proprietor of the website EidPrayLove.com. I love it. Basil, I hope that your creativity inspires the kind of creativity in others that you've demonstrated. It's a great idea. Thank you for doing it. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Welton, for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I love this show this week. So many encouraging and creative ideas that we've dealt with. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners, if you really do like this kind of radio, is essential to keeping this show on the air. I want to thank you if you've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And please share the stories that you find compelling with your friends. They need to be in on this too. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. This is not a time that we can take anything for granted. If you find value in what you hear, please spread the word. People need to know the things we've been talking about on this show today. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Was the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me. Was the son of a preacher man, you see what he was. Mm-hmm.